Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A funding cliff for federal food assistance looms, with 700,000 Wisconsinites likely to not receive food share benefits. Plus, the State Insurance Commission projects big cost increases for health care as Wisconsin lawmakers point fingers. And $15 million has been released as a fraction of Governor Tony Evers' prison overhaul plan. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for October 31st. I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Happy Halloween.
Same to you.
I am here dressed as the host of Rewind. And we're getting started this week with this sort of ongoing federal funding battle over, this time over SNAP payments, which are due to lapse for the first time in history on Saturday. There's been about a little more than a week of kind of push-pull. The USDA announced that the well has run dry on SNAP payments. The governor sent a letter and then joined a lawsuit to kind of try to force contingency funds from the federal government. But sort of barring any of that, we are, I should say, waiting on potential action in that lawsuit could happen today. But barring any of that, these payments could lapse. That's food share that covers 700,000 Wisconsinites could lapse as of Saturday. And we are seeing kind of, a politicization of this. So Democrats blaming Republicans, Republicans blaming Democrats. Governor Tony Evers said that President Trump and Republicans in Congress must work across the aisle and end this shutdown now so Wisconsinites and Americans across our country have access to basic necessities like food and groceries. Mary Fells Kaus has said that, you know, GOP leadership in the legislature will not release state funds to backfill anything that goes missing. She said, "I just wish that the Democrats would sign this continuing resolution and vote for it, and let's move on. They shouldn't be playing games like this. You don't hold people hostage over these kinds of issues. So no, I don't see it stepping in." So again, that question of what could the state be doing to backfill these lost tens of millions of dollars that go towards SNAP.
So the governor actually had a proposal earlier this year trying to blunt the what he saw as the impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. There was some money in there, I believe, for SNAP. Probably going to take that up. I've seen an idea floated now that, oh, there's this COVID money that the governor could just, like, reallocate. That actually doesn't work. So remember, with all these COVID packages from the federal government, there were deadlines to obligate the money and then to spend the money. The last piece of it had to be obligated by December 31st of 2024. That means, like, you basically sign contracts. You're going to spend this money on X. And spent by December 31st of 2026. As of June 30th, there was $373 million left to be spent, or been allocated, hadn't spent yet. And again, I've seen people say, well, just reallocate that money for SNAP. Why isn't the governor doing this? Well, it's because of the Treasury rules from the federal government. They say that, yes, you can reallocate money in certain situations, such as if I paid you $50 million on you for a contract, you spent 48 of it. I have $2 million left over. I can reallocate that money. However, it must go toward an expense based on the books by December 31st of 2024. Those are current rules. You could, in theory, ask federal government for a change in the rules to allow you more freedom. But barring that, there isn't an avenue to use COVID money, which seems to be Republicans' go-to answer of like, oh, we have a veterans issue with these homes. Governor should spend COVID money because they're frustrated. He spent all this money on his own. That's a different topic. That said, we are in an impasse about SNAP and the federal government in general. And here's one more example of the pressure points of this standoff.
Yeah, I reached out to GOP leaders in the Assembly and the Senate to ask whether they would go into extraordinary session. Didn't hear back. I think that Felskowski comment has kind of been pointed to as like where Republicans in the legislature are leaning. But we've seen in other states, both Republican and Democratic governors have declared states of emergency so that they can kind of tap into funds. I spent a lot of time this week talking to, you know, food bank and food pantry service providers who basically say that they are anticipating needing to fill a huge gap in people people's grocery budgets. One person quoted me that essentially for low-income people, SNAP covers something like 90% of their food needs, and then food banks cover about the other 10%. And so if SNAP isn't coming through, that's just a huge spike in need really across the state. And I think this is one of those issues, you know, food insecurity affects rural people, urban people, older, younger families. 40% of SNAP recipients in Wisconsin are children. And so it is one of these things that across the political divide, there is, I think, some harmony on wanting to make sure that people have access to food. It's, again, just always an argument over mm-hmm. how to accomplish that. And then we are also seeing that same sort of politicization take place among our delegation. So some spat between Representative Derek Van Orden this week and Senator Tammy Baldwin. Derek Van Orden told you that he would support backfilling SNAP. He says that he actually used that program as a kid, and he blamed Tammy Baldwin, or I should say Senate Democrats, for kind of the ongoing shutdown. And then Tammy Baldwin kind of fired back and said, while Congressman Van Orden is on day 40 of his paid vacation, meaning the House of Representatives is not in while the Senate is, Senator Baldwin has been in Washington working with her colleagues to lower health care costs and reopen the government. So again, this kind of real political push-pull, pointing fingers as this program is due to lapse.
So the question becomes, what's the off-ramp going to be? The House has been out, as you pointed out. They keep saying that there is an offer on the table to bring the feds back in, to reopen the government. It's all about Democrats. The Senate has voted 13 times, I think, on continuing resolutions. Baldwin and Democrats have opposed all of them. I think John Fetterman from Pennsylvania is the only Democrat that vote for any of them. So we're just kind of, again, twiddling our thumbs, waiting for the government to reopen. I think we're getting close to the longest shutdown ever.
Yeah. And so, of course, the sticking point is these ACA tax subsidies, Affordable Care Act. And we got some projections this week from the Office of the Insurance Commissioner.
Yes.
There we go. Always with the alphabet soup here in Wisconsin. And so we will start with Governor Evers, who like brought out these numbers and makes sort of the Democratic case that without these COVID era tax credits, people's premiums will go up quite significantly. So we'll start with some video from Tony Evers.
In 2025, 88% of Wisconsinites enrolled in coverage on healthcare.gov. They qualified for tax credits, saving an average of $664 a month. And without these enhanced tax credits, healthcare premiums for Wisconsinites are going to skyrocket, period. Many Wisconsinites will see their premiums double, and some of them will see staggering increases in this, no kidding, of over $30,000 per year. Accessible, affordable health care shouldn't only be for the healthy and wealthy, but that's exactly what's going to happen if Congress doesn't act.
And so then, obviously, Republicans disagree with that assessment. They say that the system, the Affordable Care Act system in general, is unsustainable, that those tax credits were never meant to be long-term. And so an example of this kind of argument comes from Representative Tony Weed from DePere. The Affordable Care Act, which passed without a single Republican vote, has made healthcare anything but affordable. Governor Evers should urge Tammy Baldwin to join us and vote to reopen the government so we can get to work on lowering healthcare costs for hardworking Wisconsin families. So again, these numbers come out, and we'll take a look at those numbers in a moment, but it is that finger pointing, who is to blame, and then meanwhile the shutdown continues.
So remember back in March, Democrats voted, some of them, to for continuing resolution to keep government open. That brought a torrent of criticism from Democratic voters that they weren't fighting hard enough, because Trump is there is a certain passion inspired in the Dem base by Donald Trump. They want to oppose whatever he does, so Democrats had some issues with their base because they weren't fighting back. So with the second round of a continuing resolution, there was a thought in D.C. among Republicans that, okay, moderate Democrats, when push comes to shove, when we get close to the shutdown, we'll cave, just like they did back in March. That didn't happen. So, okay, we've seen like all these pressure points keep coming. So we've talked about SNAP already. We've talked about the subsidies, Affordable Care Act. What is the pressure point that finally paves the way for something to happen? There's an election on Tuesday in New Jersey and Virginia. I hate to be a cynic, but you could argue that if you're a Democrat, you don't want to deflate your base ahead of a big election. It's going to be seen as a referendum on Donald Trump and a predictor of what's going to happen in 2026. I'm not saying what's going on, but you're looking for what's that offer and what would take that pressure off. And Republicans have kept saying, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And each time Democrats have held firm. Okay, but what's the Democrats' offer? What is their way out of this? They keep saying, give us the vote on subsidies and we can talk. Republicans keep saying, open the government, then we'll talk. Nobody trusts each other. So the question, I guess, out there is, do you have to have Donald Trump get involved? Now, I've read coverage in D.C. of Republicans saying, well, if Trump gets involved, he's a wild card. He might just say, yeah, I want a deal, get this thing done. So we are in, again, this continued standoff. The question is, what's the pressure point that finally breaks this? Is it air traffic controllers walking off the job saying, we're not getting paid, we're not going to do this anymore? Governor Evers announced yesterday two Head Start programs are closing classrooms in Wisconsin, one in Sheboygan, one in southwestern Wisconsin. Is that going to, what is the end game? What is the pressure point that finally paves the way for a deal?
Yeah, and so to take a look at that, you pulled some numbers from about what kind of premium rise there could be. The question is sort of whether you're under or over 400% of the federal poverty limit. And so looking at some of those numbers, you know, increases if you are just under 400%. In Dane County, for example, it's a 9% hike. If you're just over, it's a 102% hike. In Waukesha County, if you're just under, a 2% increase. If you're just over, a 102% increase. You can kind of go down the list. But again, this is like this question of what is that pressure point. One of the things that, you know, these service providers that I've been speaking to have said is that if you are a family receiving SNAP, for example, you might also be receiving healthcare tax credits, right? You are at the intersection of all of these different kind of services, and so, and particularly kind of federal services. And so at what point in this shutdown, you know, do people need to, do lawmakers want to respond to which forms of federal dollars are or are not kind of like affecting their constituents?
And it's particularly important in Wisconsin because remember, with the Affordable Care Act, the opportunity to expand Medicaid for those between 100% of poverty and 133%, they could get onto the Medicaid program. Wisconsin did not under Scott Walker and Republicans. They took those, that population, and put them on these exchanges. For them, this is their healthcare option. Now, you could also argue that employers aren't providing enough options. I've seen lots of stories like you have about Amazon and Walmart and how their employees are on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for us, this is a big deal because we are not, didn't do the expansions for this population. It's particularly important to have this option.
So definitely keeping an eye on that, and again, keeping an eye on that lawsuit about SNAP, and just it seems like every day there's both a lot of news and no news about the shutdown. Speaking of sort of a lot and a little all at once, we got our first poll about next year's election, which we are basically officially 1 year out from now, and I think the main result is that most voters don't watch Rewind because most of them don't know anything about either the gubernatorial candidates or even the Supreme Court candidates, and that's an election that's coming up much sooner in about 5 months. So for Democrats, 81% have no primary choice for governor, 70% of Republicans have no primary choice, 94% of voters say they have not heard much or anything about the governor's campaign. Again, they should tune in here. Of the candidates that have declared, Tom Tiffany has the highest name recognition among Republicans. David Crowley has the most name recognition among Democrats, very narrowly beating out Sarah Rodriguez. But 84 to 86% of voters do not know anything about either Supreme Court candidate. So those are some jarring numbers, I think, for those of us in the political news business.
Well, it's also a reflection of the reality that people don't tune in until like the last couple months. So look at the governor's race first. This is purely a gauge of name ID right now. How are well-known people? And the answer is not much. I mean, Tom Tiffany has been a member of Congress now for 5 years, a little more than that. He was in the state legislature before that, so he's got more of a base, a bigger district than David Crowley does. Sarah Rodriguez has been lieutenant governor for 2.5 years, you know, 3 years, so not very well known. Okay, what's that mean? Well, honestly, not much. So what these guys are doing right now is they're doing events, trying to like talk to their partisan bases and raise money. To raise money because then they can spend money to raise their name ID. And Charles Frank, the political director, talked about this in the presentation. This is not a big surprise because name ID will pop up between July and June and August for these primaries. You'll start to see ads. Those ads will resonate, the candidates hope, and then you'll see numbers rise. The question is who's going to have the money and who's going to be able to pick up their name ID. Sarah Rodriguez, for example, talked a couple weeks ago about how she had $4.5 million committed to her. Now that is $2 million from the Democratic Lieutenant Governor's Association for independent expenditures. And then there is money that she's raised, she said about $400,000 a few weeks ago, and then $2.1 million was committed to her campaign that donors are going to give to other groups that support her to do stuff on her behalf. Well, if that's real, that's a lot of money to raise your name ID between now and August. The question is, when do you start spending it? The rule of thumb in politics is you take your budget for ads and go, okay, I have this much money. That means I can do this much TV or digital, whatever. you count backward from the primary, and that's when you start your ad campaign. Well, we have early voting in Wisconsin. So you start for the early voting. Like, is that your new start date? And if you spend your money too early and it doesn't resonate, you have a hard time getting more money to keep up. So it's a big kind of like guessing, not a guessing game, but kind of a strategy of what to do. These numbers also underscore why Mandela Barnes is like kind of this potential front runner, because you go, okay, in this poll, Francesca Hong is at 6%, which good for Francesca, but the margin of error is plus or minus 6.5% roughly in the poll. So that means she could be at zero or she could be at 13. So my point is, these head-to-heads doesn't mean a whole lot. But if you're Mandela Barnes, you go, hey, there's a huge opportunity there. If I step in right away, I'm better known than all these guys. I ran in 2022. I've got national fundraising. I raised 40-some million dollars my campaign for U.S. Senate 2022. I could be a real force, which has Democrats worried. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them, because they see 2022 and go, yeah, but you lost Ron Johnson. It's, that race is fast. It's kind of like a political Rorschach test. On the one hand, you had Mandela Barnes, who lost to an incumbent, right? Power of incumbency is a big deal. Incumbent politicians don't lose a whole lot. For U.S. Senate, Russ Feingold lost in 2010 in my career. That's been it. Everybody else wins. So that's a challenge. So he came really close, raised $40 million, all these, but he also lost to an incumbent who's not very popular and hasn't been the whole time he's been in office. So there's like this field, a group of people saying he can't win next November. The Milwaukee Courier encouraged him not to run last week in an editorial. New York Times story came out, like raising all these Democrat concerns. So he's a very polarizing candidate. And I'm sure it's a coincidence, but his long run pack put out a poll Monday morning saying, in a head-to-head with Tom Tiffany, who's in the race for governor, and Tim Michaels, who's been mentioned as a candidate, he's at 50 or 51%. Now, people I talked to were like a little skeptical. We're a year out from an election, so anybody at 50% or more would be kind of unusual. But he's sending a message of, I'm stronger than you guys think I am. So my guess is, from my talk to people, he'll be in another couple of weeks, mid-November-ish, we're kind of guessing. Then it becomes, he has a name ID. Do people want that brand? Are they really buying the Mandela Barnes brand? Are they saying, ah, I remember 2022, I can't go there again?
Right. Do they want something different? Is this a time to kind of be reassessing things? And especially with national politics being what they are, we kind of see that play out in the governor's race. I think, too, we'll be looking at the Supreme Court election, which, you know, hinges on different factors. I think people who tend to turn out in spring elections are kind of more committed voters anyways. And there's a lot more just about which candidate aligns with Republican Party and values, which aligns with Democratic Party and values. And so it's less about the two candidates, I think, having strong name recognition versus just making sure that you know, like, they're on the left side or they're on the right side of things. And so that'll also, I think, kind of tell us a little bit, or maybe tell some of those gubernatorial candidates a little bit about who they need to be reaching out to based on the outcome of that election.
And remember, Maria Lazar said, she announced, I'm not going to talk about my decisions or values. I'm going to talk about, like, that's not good. The poll shows voters want that. They want to know where you are. So she's out of touch with the bases. Also, looking at the poll results, there's some bad numbers there for Lazar, because nobody's going to tell a pollster, I'm not going to vote in the spring. But 74% of Democrats say, I'm definitely going to vote. 69% of Republicans, I'm skeptical that it'll turn out. But it underscores the gap that we're seeing in spring elections. The electorate is like plus five for Democrats just out of the gate. And if you add in Donald Trump and Elon Musk like this spring, you get a 10-point win. So there are some warning signs for Lazar in the spring. Don't forget, too, talk about that motivation. This past April, Susan Crawford got 1.3 million votes. Tim Michaels, a member of 22, got 1.268 million votes. Like, that is mind-blowing how motivated liberals are in an off-year election because of Donald Trump. It's something to worry about for a Republican for next fall. I don't take an April electorate ever and put on to a November, but that gives you a base number where Democrats are at for almost any election statewide.
So we will continue to watch that polling, and maybe as we go forward, some of those candidates will have more than single-digit responses. Also this week, Planned Parenthood announced that it is resuming abortion services. This comes about 3 weeks after abortion services briefly stopped. This is because the Trump budget bill barred abortion providers from accepting Medicaid for other services as long as they provided abortions, and so there was a pause here. But the kind of solution that Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin came to is that they dropped their essential community provider status. That's something that's given to kind of safety net providers, so healthcare providers that primarily serve low-income people. And that comes out of this court filing that basically said in order to comply with the budget bill and to continue accepting Medicaid, either they need to stop providing abortion or they need to drop that status. And so they kind of went with this solution. Tanya Atkinson told reporters this week, CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, that they are still figuring out actually like what it means to give up that ECP status. And so this is really one of those issues that's kind of very much live in the water.
And they also said they don't expect it to impact access or what they're doing. So we shall see, kind of up in the air. Also a lawsuit challenging this version in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So a lot to be determined there. But this issue I'm watching is it still a live one next fall and next spring? Mm-hmm. So if this stays live, it'll impact the Supreme Court race and the governor's race next fall.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, a lot of these kind of unprecedented is always the word that we go to, but kind of unprecedented challenges. And so we're seeing it play out. You know, this is one of those things that like national editors always get in touch about because Wisconsin can often be kind of the testing lab, let's say, for some of these things. And so we're seeing that with Planned Parenthood here as well. There was also a meeting of the State Building Commission this week, which is not normally, I think, something that we talk about on Rewind, but they released $15 million to go towards the governor's prison overhaul plan. Notably, he requested, I think, $540-some-odd million dollars earlier this year, so a small fraction of this half-billion-dollar ask. And it moved through with Republican support, even though his overall plan got a lot of kind of criticism from Republicans at the time who felt essentially shut out of the process. He developed this real kind of intricate Rube Goldberg machine kind of plan in which every closure necessitated another opening and moving folks around and this kind of thing. Republicans did not love that. They don't love being handed something by the Democratic governor and told, you know, sign this or nothing else will work. And so we saw a little bit of that kind of fight play out during the building commission meeting, and we'll take a look at some of that video right now.
Once you are finished with your design, you will bring it back here for an up or down vote. But no one will be included, from what I'm hearing from you, as to what buildings will be, how we move forward. Are you including anybody that's been working on this from the majority and the minority parties inside this building? Or is that just a design team at Building Commission making those decisions?
This is important for the state of Wisconsin to understand that we are serious about this project. My promise to you is that this is one step of many, and that step will include all the legislators that want to be involved. We've tried to do that in the past. What we have thus far didn't come just from us, it came from other legislators, and so we're hoping for that to happen going forward.
So that's $15 million that would go towards the planning and design of this. But can you walk us through kind of the history? This has been, prisons in Wisconsin has been a heated political topic for longer than I've been here, and there's been this kind of back and forth about how exactly to address some of these really big needs.
We've been through the political prison wars. There was the opening of Stanley Prison 22, 3 years ago. It was a privately built prison that developers built and then said, here, you probably want to buy this. It was really a long story, but they had to retrofit it to make it up to grade. Really, this history should start with Lincoln Hills in Copper Lake. So story broke 7, 8 years ago that staff were mistreating the youthful offenders being held there. There was this mad rush in 2018, we call it CYA, to try and get something done. That bill that was written and passed with the bipartisan support set a deadline to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and put aside $80 million to fund two new Type 1 facilities for the kind of the worst of the worst for juvenile offenders, and then to fund county-run facilities, they call them CIRCSEs, I won't give the alphabet soup for that one, that would house less serious offenders. That bill was underfunded and was not realistic. To give you an idea, the new Dane County Type 1 facility in the budget that's funded this time, $130 million, okay? So we've been trying to like work through this botched process for years. Then you had post-2018, Governor Evers took over. Republicans are not gonna give Evers a win on Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. Now, the governor also botched trying to site two new Type 1 facilities. He picked a place in the Fox Valley that residents were happy about. So that blew up in a controversy. So there's all these missteps back and forth. here we are now, February, the governor says, look, we need to do something. Green Bay will pawn date to the 1800s. Everybody agrees Green Bay has to close. That presents a problem. The governor's plan was to, as you said, keep moving people around, close Green Bay. The problem with this plan for Republicans was, among other things, it would reduce capacity by 700 beds. We are currently over capacity by several thousand inmates. They said that's the problem. The governor wants to turn Waupun into a vocational village, which basically means they would tear down all of the existing cell blocks, build them new, and have it focused on job training. He also wants to expand earned release for nonviolent offenders, then 4 years of release. No go for Republicans. They see that as releasing bad people into society. The other backstory is Republicans and Evers have not worked together very well the whole time he's been in office. Yes, we had a budget this year that had some bipartisan compromise. Yes, in 2021, 23, we had the shared revenue deal and deals on like arenas and things like that. But overall, stuff like this, they've not worked well together. And the complaint from Republicans over and over again is the governor throws something out and says, here, you got to pass this whole thing or it's not going to work, which we did in February. Now you have this culmination, this question of can they get something done? So $15 million is for the planning of a new system. Now, the fruition of this, if it comes together, will be after Evers leaves office. But can Governor Evers really include Republicans in the design process, get their feedback, everybody on board with like what's going to look like? Remember, Evers in 2018 said he shared the goal of cutting the prison population in half. This would not do that. All kinds of complicating factors. But for a governor who's leaving, who's a lame duck, this could be a huge test of can you finally, besides those a couple of wins, get a big win on something that's been devil the state for years before you walk out the door.
Yeah, and in that video, he did seem to suggest that they would be working together. And I believe he also said something like, let's get something GD done.
Yes.
So some forceful words there. Very quickly, we had a couple announcements of candidates in the 7th Congressional District. So this is the one that Tom Tiffany currently holds, but he is running for governor. So Michael Alfonso, this is kind of this open question. He is the son-in-law of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. He finally announced, and then Paul Oskren, who has said that he will put $1 million of his own money. So these are kind of the two newest Republican candidates in the race.
Other Republicans, Kevin Hermaning is a former Marathon County GOP chair up there, was a Marine who was taken captive in the Middle East back in 1979. Great profile. We'll see if he's going to run. He looks like he's going to. Dewey Strobel, Republican lawmaker from suburban Milwaukee, has a vacation home up in the 7th. He might run. We'll see. So lots of kind of interesting things to watch, but the big question is money. So Paul says $1 million of his own money. Sean Duffy has $2.2 million in his campaign account. He could make that into a super PAC and help Michael. Oh, and by the way, will Donald Trump endorse in that primary? That could be a huge end-all be-all.
Yeah, so lots to watch there. And that takes us to the stock report. We just had Scarlett Johnson of Moms for Liberty won a First Amendment case in the Court of Appeals, a defamation lawsuit.
So a big thing in defamation is proving a statement is true or false. Apparently, calling somebody a woke warrior for a woke white warrior, a white savior, those things you can't prove true or false. Ergo, Scarlett Johnson knocking this teacher in southeastern Wisconsin is not defamation. So the background is, you know, Scarlett and others and Moms for Liberty have been very unhappy with the DEI. There was this teacher and social justice coordinator who retired or left the school district in 22. Her LinkedIn profile is still up. Johnson got the LinkedIn profile, put a bunch of comments on it. The person sued. The circuit court judge said, well, some of these things you can't sue about, some you might be able to. The appeals court stepped in and said, no, it's all off the table. This is it. Now, it's not done yet. The woman who sued is considering an appeal, but this is a win for First Amendment, for her rights to say these kinds of things and to kick these shots at people over DEI.
Mixed, we have Mandela Barnes. We talked about him a little bit, the potential huge name recognition he could have.
So is he going to get in? And if he does, what's it going to be like? And I want to kind of build on what I said before. In 2022, he was the front runner in that primary for U.S. Senate because he had name ID. He had some wealth of support in the base, and he raised a decent amount of money. His challengers, Sarah Galuski, now the Secretary of State, used to be the treasurer, Alex Lazary, former Bucks executive, Tom Nelson, accounting executive. Nobody took a political shot at Mandela for a couple reasons. One, they weren't sure it would work. If you won't go negative, it could bounce back on you. And two, the others, they might benefit from it. And so Mandela gets to the primary. basically unscathed. Republicans had no qualms whatsoever about these attacks. I mean, holding an abolish ICE t-shirt, comments about the police, et cetera, they went after him full force. In the end, he closed the gap. I mean, National Democrats left Mandela Barnes in the dust in mid-August of 2022. They came around later on, we raised this money, got close, but still lost. Can he, like, turn that into a win? There's always this question of, you know, if you've lost once, can you win after that? I mean, we have all kinds of examples. Tom Tiffany lost several bids for state senate or legislature before he won eventually. Can you turn the page? We'll see. And the thing about name ID is it's not just that you have name ID, that people like that name ID. So will people buy the Mandela brand and want him to be the nominee going forward? Republicans would love that. They think this guy has got a ceiling and that he's a weak front runner that would be not a great candidate in the general election. And we'll see.
And speaking of brand falling this week is Donald Trump's brand.
So look, Trump, believe it or not, has never been above water with his job approval rate in the entire Marquette poll, his entire first four-year term and so far this term. So the fact that underwater in this one's not a surprise. The question is the trend line going to change? So he's upside down like about 6 or 7 points in this one, a little bit worse than last one. The first one in February was like 3 or 4 points. What I'm wondering is, where's that going to go come 26? Because he will be a factor in the Supreme Court race in the spring and next fall. Go back to 2022. He actually was 47-50 with registered voters in the last poll before the election. Evers won by 3.4 percentage points. So if, and Ron Johnson won by a point, if Trump gets to like just minus 2 or 3, okay, you know, that's okay for a public environment. If he's minus 6, minus 7, minus 8, that makes it much more difficult. And then you look at the issues. People aren't happy about tariffs. They're not happy about inflation. So the president won in part because of inflation and Joe Biden. If you don't fix that by next fall, what's the Republican brand going to look like? And there's a very confusing point of data in this poll. The Democratic brand stinks. It is upside down by 20-some points in this poll. That's not good. That's when they point out to me that people vote for the candidate, not the brand. So, yeah, the brand isn't great, but maybe it'll be okay for the nominee. But I'm watching to Trump. He is such a driving force in everything in politics. If he can't turn this around, it's a problem for Republicans next year in Wisconsin.
Before we wrap up, you know, there's like a lot of people behind the scenes at the Capitol who are the reason that we are able to do our jobs, and we want to shout out one of them today.
Richard Champagne is the director of Reference Bureau, retiring. He's been at job since 2014. Been in state service, I believe, since the mid-80s, took a break. He was actually assistant professor of political science at UW, went to law school, came back, but he's retiring at the end of the session, so good luck to Richard.
Yeah, and thank you so much for everything that you do and the LRB does for us all the time, and that'll do it for us at Rewind. I am Anya Wagtendonk.
I'm J.R. Ross.
And we will see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.